Stand by for another We Are Human Leaders episode shortly. But first, we're glad to announce an incredible opportunity for you to be a part of the inaugural Human Leaders Certification in 2023. This immersive and dynamic certification isn't your standard leadership training. You see, it's not just about learning, it's about becoming a human leader. Over 10 months, you'll evolve into a certified and embodied human leader, supported by a community of your peers sharing the journey with you. This program is ideal for leaders from all walks of life seeking to take part in a cutting-edge and transformative leadership certification. Limited spots are available and they're filling fast. So register now at www.wearehumanleaders.com/certification. Now let's dive into the episode.
Welcome to the We Are Human Leaders podcast. I'm Sally Clark, and today my co-host Alexa Sana and I are speaking with Claude Silver, Chief Heart Officer at global company VaynerMedia. As a motivational speaker, thought leader, and industry trendsetter, Claude focuses on teaching how to disrupt the traditional HR model with the use of emotional optimism and heart-centered leadership to develop elite performance, create cultures of belonging, empower teams to be purpose-driven, efficient, and strong, and infuse companies with empathy, humanity, and joy. Today, we explore what it means to be a Chief Heart Officer, how Claude lives her purpose of being of joyful service, her definition of emotional optimism, and the day-to-day measurable impact of heart-centered leadership at VaynerMedia. Claude is an absolute delight. We hope you enjoy this deep, exploratory conversation as much as we did. Let's delve in.
Welcome to We Are Human Leaders, Claude. It is an absolute delight to have you with us today. And before we get into a little bit more about your role at VaynerMedia, we'd love to get to know you a little bit more first and your personal journey that's brought you to the current role that you're in as Chief Heart Officer at VaynerMedia.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much for having me. And I love the title of your podcast. So, yay. Right. So I don't come from the world of HR. I grew up in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which is not New York and it's not LA. It's in the Southwest. So my love of the outdoors and just being in nature really has been with me my whole life, and thus then playing with people in the outdoors. So team has always been very important to me. I was a really poor student. So fortunately, I had the outdoors and I had sports to fall back on, I should say, to help me with my own confidence and all that other stuff. I was in San Francisco for 18 years, and that's really where I got my start in this digital world. I spent a lot of time kind of schooling myself in life. I did a lot of clairvoyant training and intuitive reading training and Buddhism training, just things that really like speak to me and that every day today. And I found myself anyway at advertising agencies. It was the time. It was the dot-com boom, the first one, right in 1998 or so. And I just went straight into the digital world, and one thing led to another. And I found myself in London in 2009 working for a very large agency. And really, I was a strategist. So really getting, you know, trying to figure out insights and audience and getting a product into your hands. London was amazing for me because I left 18 years of San Francisco and kind of started again in many ways. And all along, I've always been that kind of player coach, that kind of mentor, just like gathering people. You know, I'm a late bloomer, so I'm always there for like late bloomers and people that I just want to be like an island that people can swim to, I would say. And I met Gary Vaynerchuk, my CEO, in about 9 years ago. And one thing led to another, and he moved me to New York, where I started at VaynerMedia. So I've been there 8.5 years, and I love it. It's the longest career I've had. It's the longest place I've ever been, longest relationship.
Fantastic. I love that it's been a journey. It sounds like that's quite intuitive as well. Like you've been not in a particular And if I'm understanding correctly, I might be projecting a little because this resonates for me, but not with a particular goal of this is what my career path is going to look like, but really sort of following what intuitively feels like the right shift at the right time.
You're totally spot on. And I have to say, you know, I'm a Gen Xer and, everyone around me was, had their eye on the prize. I'm going to do this. I want to go to law school. And I didn't. I really didn't. And I think, I really had to work that through with my parents that there was another way, A, for me to learn and B, for me to figure it out. And fortunately, it has worked out. I mean, the red thread in my life is really keeping the heartbeat going. Whatever I'm doing, if I'm, coaching tennis or getting people into the water surfing or, working on a spreadsheet, it's like, how can I facilitate growth and transformation here?
That's a beautiful red thread. And I think it brings me to my next question, which is I'm curious about this concept of emotional optimism, which you speak about on your website. And I'm really curious specifically if you can sort of tell us a little bit, help us sort of break it down and understand it, and also differentiate it from what we might think of as positivity.
Yeah. So it's nothing like toxic positivity. Toxic positivity is like the sky is falling, but hey, even though you still have a job, right? Like chin up. That's what toxic positivity is about. And, in this day and age, no one's going to chin up. There's no need to chin up anymore. And so emotional optimism for me is the, taking the idea of understanding we're all emotional. We all have tons of emotions every single day, every hour of every day. Using those emotions not to define us, but rather to inform us as it's not I am sad. That situation made me sad. That conversation made me sad. I'm not sad. Using those as guideposts, if you will, or data, and then knowing that we, with the support of other people, have the opportunity to change that narrative. So emotional, we're emotional, but to change the narrative to one that is more hopeful, that has more of a blue sky that will show you the possibilities for yourself. And I do think this is for anyone, not just corporate America. I think it's for anyone. So it's the fact that we have the ability to change the narrative and that there's support around us to do that, especially in the workplace. And that's the shift we need to make.
I would totally agree with you there, Claude. And I think for a very long time, I was certainly one of the toxically positive people or had the discomfort of being in my emotions and the constant need to reframe them almost immediately. But what I'm hearing from this is that emotional optimism isn't about bypassing or avoiding or denying our reality, but it's about experiencing it, knowing that the future still has light at the end of the tunnel, even if today feels really crappy or we're really angry or we're really sad or everything's gone wrong in life and work, there still will be an out at some point.
Yeah, the sun will shine. Again.
Yeah.
Right. And even if you're at the bottom of the sea, you will float to the top at some point.
Yeah. Agreed. And I think using those emotions, as you mentioned, Claude, to be a marker, to be a messenger for what's going on inside us, especially things like anger, like fear, frustration in the business environment, they're really beneficial to signal to us, hey, maybe I need to stop and think about, are my needs being met in this job? Or has this person wronged me in a way that I'm actually not comfortable with? And is it beneficial for me to just bypass that experience and say everything's okay? Or do I need to set a boundary here? Do I need to address this head on versus sweep it under the rug? And there's recent research published here in Australia that suggests that's really our leadership style is avoid conflict, avoid discomfort. And it does us a huge disservice in the leadership realm as well.
Yeah, it sure does. And it puts all of the onus on the individual to figure it out. Not everyone has tools or access to tools or support systems to figure or therapy to figure it out. So the anxiety just continues and continues. Cortisol levels shoot up and your performance is, forget it. You're no longer performing at a high level. So it only behooves all of us to get real about what's going on, not only in the world, but the cultures that we inhabit, knowing that nothing is utopic, and there are going to be bumps in the road. And together we can figure this out.
I love also, Claude, that you zoom in also on the sort of the language that we use around emotions. Like you said, rather than saying I am sad, describing the way the situation is making me sad. And sometimes I feel like when I bring this point that people think I'm just being a really sort of pedantic about the use of language, but I really believe that how we talk about our emotions and states and allowing them to be a temporary state, that really does have a connection with our brain, with our neurology. That really has an impact on how we experience life and even our beliefs about what we can expect in life as well.
Yeah, I love that you said that. They're temporary. They are temporary. I mean, Rilke says, you know, no feeling is final. You know, it's very, very true. And I believe that if we can bring this into our workplaces more and more, and language is extremely important, making sure that we're speaking to someone's hearing, right? Because all three of us hear things very differently based on who we are. We have the opportunity to becoming more authentic, more transparent, and certainly more vulnerable in the workplace. And that's not a weakness. We have to change that stigma of that word, vulnerable. And Brené Brown obviously has done a great job in doing that.
Yeah, it does feel like we're coming leaps and strides in that space right now. And creating the space for organizations to do that certainly feels like there's still a level of discomfort or understanding how we actually truly shift into that. But I'm very optimistic that we're headed in the right direction. And, you know, I want to move into this question now, Claude, around the concept of what leadership actually means to you. And again, looking at some of your previous work around emotional optimism, but also you speak to this term called joyful service. And I'd love to dive into that a little bit more and understand, how is joyful service part of leadership to you? What does this mean? Can you break it down for us?
Joyful service is actually my purpose. It's Claude's purpose, to be of joyful service. I could just say to be of service, but why not put some joy in there? Why not sprinkle it with some positivity, some possibility, you know, a little bit of like maraca shaking every now and then? Because this is it. We get one shot here. We got one shot. And so my purpose, Claude's purpose, is to be of service, to facilitate growth and change every single place I can, and to bring that emotional optimism, that joy. Not saying I'm bringing joy to sad times. That's not what it is. But to create and hold space for another human being, for me, is not only an honor, it does bring me joy. It fills me up to be a passenger with someone else. So I don't think everyone has to have joyful service on their, you know, their signature. That's, you know, every leader, that's for them to decide. But I do believe as leaders, we are not the heroes. We are here to turn other people into their better, best selves, to get them to be the champion that they know they are inside, but they need some help. Look, I needed help. I needed a lot of help for several years. And little by little, I was able to find mentors or to find things that I was very interested in terms of educating myself, that helped me change that narrative or the limiting beliefs that I had going on. And I think that's the one of the many roles of a leader, which is to, you know, I don't even want to say service. I don't want to say servant anymore, but to provide space, to provide safety, you know, to run into the fire, to make sure, like, I got your back. Like, I got your back is a very empathetic thing to say. And where do you hear that in the working world? Not very many places.
Yeah, often it comes after we've proven ourselves or something like that, doesn't it?
Yeah, because we're so good at praise. Great job. Mm-hmm. Did a great job. Oh, that was awesome. But praise is like, yeah, we all need it, but praise is also cheap and cheerful. Mm. Praise isn't getting to the heart of it. Like, hey, listen, you matter to me. And these are the ways you matter to me.
Praise almost feels to me like there's an element of conditionality about it. It's like, you've done something good, therefore I will give you some approval. It's conditional on you having done something good. Whereas holding space for someone and really listening to who they are, seeing them for who they are, is almost an unconditional sort of space to be in. And I think that in terms of our basic, you know, human psychological needs, is such a massive gift to be able to give someone and to give teams as well in a work setting.
Yeah, echo that for sure.
I'm curious, Claude, I believe that when your role of chief heart officer was announced, that Gary Vaynerchuk said, we want to build the best human empire in the history of time. I'm curious about this term human empire, and I'm wondering if you can explain to us what that means, a human empire.
Yeah, And the other way he has said it is, we want to build the single greatest human organization in the history of time. I like that sentence more than empire.
Okay.
I know what he means by empire, which is really ecosystem.
Right.
It's a places for people to flourish. And so when people are at Vayner, I want to make this the best career choice of their life. Whether or not they're there for 2 years, 7 years, 13 years, 5 months, I want them to be able to look back in time and say, you know what, those 7 years I spent at Vayner, they were life altering. Maybe they met their spouse. Maybe they got a double promotion. Maybe they learned a new skill or skills. Maybe they enjoyed work and didn't go to work with Sunday scaries, whatever that is. So Gary has always said, we want people to stay here forever. What that means is in the ecosystem or in the empire. And that doesn't mean with Vayner attached to it. It means that someone leaves. We have a very strong alumni organization. Someone leaves and we help place them at that next role. You know, we get hit up, you know, all day long about from other CMOs and whatnot, looking for people that we have. So that's how you keep the organization full, quite frankly. That's really what that means. And human, we're human. I mean, we're not robots. We have heartbeats and we need each other.
Interestingly, Claude, it feels like that approach is almost the opposite or the antithesis of what people would consider smart business normally. It feels like it's very, almost on a spiritual level, like an abundance mindset. We want to enhance the lives of people so they move through the world in a better way and they then have their best experience at Vayner and then potentially go on and work for our competitors and have their next best experience there because we've built them into this or supported their journey as a human being. And I think so many organizations see commodities, including we have commoditized human beings, as a finite thing. And so they need to be protected. They need to be rule bound. We need to keep them here and scare them that we're the best organization. So we don't want them to leave. And it feels like Vayner has done the exact opposite of that. And I'd love to hear has that been a success for you guys at VaynerMedia or VaynerX, I guess, if this is your kind of like bigger company-wide policy, has that felt successful or has that been measurably successful for you?
Yeah, I mean, I'll give you just an example of today. You know, having a conversation with someone that I know, because I've been told, was having a rough time, a rough go of it for the last 2 months. I've never met this person. We met today. And I basically said, as I weaved my way through into the conversation, holding space, asking him how his experience has been, letting him know that this just stays here. I'm not like putting it on alert. And I said, listen, are you ready to throw in the towel? And he said, no, I'm not. And I said, if you ever get to that place right before you feel that, please hit me up. And I said to him, I'm not going to convince you to stay and I'm not going to convince you to go. I just want to have the conversation. Because as you and I know, the most important email that I get every day and Gary gets is an exit interview, and it's too late. So actually, a year ago, maybe 18 months ago, I had my team start a stay interview. So within your first 4 to 6 months, you're getting hit up with 3 questions. And it's literally the questions are, have you met your manager and understand the roles and responsibilities? And have you made friends outside of your core group? Have you met people? And it's an effective, you know, if someone's like, no, I don't have any friends. Well, guess what? We've got plenty of people to introduce you to. And then I write an email. And I say, hey, friends, please meet Sally. She's from Australia, loves surfing and just started on the creative team. Please find 15 minutes to take her out for a coffee or a Zoom. It's all the connective tissue is what makes our culture the culture it is. And the connective tissue at work is built on eliminating fear as much as we possibly can. So by telling this guy today or asking him like, hey, I know it's been really rough and I know you've been working hardcore hours. Like, do you want to quit? He could have said, yeah, I want to quit. Or he could have said what he said, like, no, I'm in it. But like, there was nothing to prevent me from asking such an honest question.
I think that's such a key component of what is, you know, essential, I think, for creating the psychological safety that harmonious workplace needs is having that level of trust and respect between people. And I can imagine that your role as chief heart officer is a big component of that psychological safety. And I loved also that you used the phrase connective tissue, because it almost feels like there's something living, breathing about this organism, this ecosystem.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I mean, I say that to anyone. And so every single Monday we've got new joiners and they all do a 3-day orientation before they get sent out into their groups or whatever, whether or not you're C-suite or you're a brand new resident, quite frankly. And they all go through the same culture program with me and other people, you know, and letting people know that this is a very different place. Like, we trust you. We trust you. The value you can show is getting in here and listening and asking questions and meeting as many people as you can. Like, you already made it. You already got the Willy Wonka, the chocolate bar, you know, sharing, like, how do you win here? It's not a word I use often, but like, you're a kind person. You're guided by kindness. You do your best to eliminate toxicity around you. If you see someone crying in the corner, you say, hey, what's up? You know, those types of things. You try to be the bigger person in every situation. And we're here together. We're here to turn each other into heroes and champions. Like, that's literally it. So it is living and breathing. And what I love is that they all know that culture is everyone's responsibility. It's not Claude's. It's not Gary's. It's everyone. It's Bob, Susan, Sarah, you know, Ishmael. Like, it's everyone's.
And it's an empowered place for employees to be in, understanding that in their way, they're contributing to that bigger connective tissue and the feel of that ecosystem. And it leads me sort of nicely into my next question, Claude, because obviously Chief Heart Officer, until this position was appointed to yourself, we hadn't really heard of this position before. So I'd love to know a little bit more around, you know, what a day in the life of a Chief Heart Officer actually looks like, and maybe how this job function differs from our traditional HR roles.
Yeah, well, we'll start there. So I think of myself very much as Switzerland. I am not here to be the judge and jury, but I am here to be able to deliver candor. So I may not, you know, I'm not here to judge anyone's creative or whatever. And I'm not here to say you're a high performer or a low performer, but I am here to say, hey, your managers, or we have all of this information that's telling us that you're not meeting the mark, or you've had so many absentee days, or by the way, you know, people really don't want to work with you. You know, that is a my job. That is part of my job. Now, the fact that I get to bob and weave anywhere I want to in the company, wherever, if I see smoke over there, like I did with the guy today, if I'm just reaching out to people that started on Monday and I want to know how they're doing, whatever it is, and I'm involved in high level recruiting meetings, people operations and resourcing, figuring out like, who do we have? Who's the best person to put over here? You know, who should we move around? That's not the right fit. Finance meetings, jam sessions. You know, today I had a jam session. I do these things called 20 at 20, and you know, 20 random people sign up, they get going to my diary, I open up Zoom, here they are. And it's 20 minutes of like, who are you? What do you do? Where are you? And then today's icebreaker was, you know, who are you going to invite alive or dead to dinner? And who from Vayner are you going to invite?
Awesome. Which
also just like, let me know that either they were inviting their boss or they were inviting their friend. And that was such a great feeling. No, like they've made friends, but people from all over the world are joining. So it's like, you could say, I want to invite Eddie Vedder because I love Pearl Jam. And that person in Amsterdam could say, I love Eddie Vedder too. And then they go off and talk about Pearl Jam. So there's something very real about just bringing people together and having fun. It costs nothing, right? And playing a little bit, taking 15, 20 minutes out of your very busy day to just chill for a second, you know, and remember that this is a very big organization, even though your office or your team is yay big. There's a lot. I do so much with DE&I and learning and development and, you know, making sure that we are hiring for skill set fit and culture addition, you know, not because you all like Pearl Jam or not because we surf together, like, because you can do the role.
Yeah, I love that you mentioned the word play in there as well, Claude, because I think that's something, and with this so much, you know, research to show how important that component of life is, which we tend to sort of file as adults as, you know, sort of undermining our how we're going to be perceived in an organization. And yet it's so key to our creativity and connection as well. I have to very quickly ask, if you gave the answer as to who you would invite dead or alive to a dinner party, I have to know who yours was.
Oh, I wanted to invite Kristen Wiig from Bridesmaids.
100%. Yeah.
And also Tina Fey, but
she's hilarious.
I just want to jam with them.
Yeah,
I really
for sure.
Yeah. Someone said Jesus today, and I was like, okay, well, all right, cool.
That'd be cool.
Interesting choice.
For sure. Yeah.
I mean, go for it. Obama was mentioned and all kinds of people. But, you know, to be able to dream with each other and just piggybacking off of what you said, you know, here we are, we're kids. Say, you know, I have young kids. They're dreaming. They're talking about magical unicorns and this and that and Frozen and that. And they just believe in fairies and blah, 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 blah. And sometime along the way, we go to school and school says to you, you can't bring your mysticism into here and your imagination. You need to be a linear thinker here, rational. And so we hide all of that dreaming. And then we go into the working world and we've already hidden that part of ourselves. Right. And then here I am, Claude Silver, saying, no, 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 let's chip away at that. Let's chip away at that armor. It's a lot. It's confusing if that's how you've been, if you've hidden yourself away to all of a sudden be in a workplace that's like, no, no, no. Actually, we want you to be your authentic self. You know, you are a fire thrower or a flamethrower on the weekends. Amazing. Maybe you can show us how to do that.
Yeah, I appreciate that, Claude. And you know, it's interesting because what I just heard you sort of mention was this concept of belonging that we know is really important now, and belonging on our own terms, not this sort of conformity to a norm or an idea. And I just want to backtrack to something I heard you say for a minute, because I hear the opposite of what you mentioned very often. And that is you hire for skill set fit and not cultural fit. And I think that's really interesting because I hear a lot of companies say, we hire for the person who fits our culture and, you know, we can build their skills, we can build their aptitude. And I just thought that was an interesting discernment because I think what I see when that is the language or that's the hiring process is we get a lot of the same people looking the same way, enjoying the same sports, liking the same band, looking like us, feeling like us. And so in terms of DE&I, it's almost the antithesis of that, isn't it? And it's almost the antithesis of belonging because you're saying, no, you can't work here unless you look like us and you think like us and you feel like us. And
yeah,
I just wanted to sort of pause on that because I often hear the opposite language to what you mentioned there.
Yeah. You know, when I took this role 6.5 years ago, and there's two things I did immediately, or three things I did immediately. One, I changed the name of the department to People and Experience because that's what we're doing here, right? I eliminated the need for a college education, with the exception in some regions and geographies where you need that. And then I changed the way we hired from culture fit to skill set fit, culture addition, because I looked on the floor and we had apples and apples and apples and apples, and we did not have any other fruits or vegetables. And that allowed us to hire for diversity on a holistic level, which also includes seen and unseen abilities and neurodiversity and diversity of thought and language, and obviously the common diversity, which we think of as, you know, race, ethnicity, sexuality, religion. So yeah, like I want a minestrone soup and we need the oregano and the bay leaves and the tomatoes.
I love that.
Absolutely. All the different flavors.
Yeah. Yep.
It sounds like what I'm hearing as well is that there's a lot of change that as Chief Heart Officer, you've been able to bring to the company and a lot of shifts that you've been able to make. So I'm wondering, for leaders who really do want to make a change within their organization and start to shift the way they're doing things and the way the company is doing things, what advice would you have as a sort of a first or a next step on their journey?
Yeah. And I love the question. And the first thing I do want to say is I empathize that not everyone works for Gary. And so I'm very fortunate that I have a CEO that believes in people and believes in the heartbeat and has given me autonomy to go and do. So I really recognize that. The things I would do immediately is like, I would go on a listening tour. Like, what's going on? What is going on under the hood, under the bonnet, as you would say? And, you know, are people feeling seen? Are they feeling marginalized? Do they get their voices heard? You know, do they get picked for the team? Do they feel like they're on or off the island? All of that stuff. And then if you have a CEO that's data driven, then I would bring that person, both quant and qual, and say, here's the data. We've got 13% of people that are engaged. Everyone else is one foot out. give me 6 months of doing some cultural activities, holding courageous conversations, making sure that people are finding their people. Give me 6 months and I'm going to then go survey that crew and let's see if there's a movement. Like those are low-hanging fruit things to do. The other thing you can do is pick up your phone and go on a Slack or go on to text or WhatsApp and just write 5 random people and say, you know what? Thank you. Like, appreciate you. Thanks for being here. Thanks for knocking it out of the park or whatever. Appreciation, recognition is so needed. And I don't mean the praise that we talked about earlier. This is like, hey, you know, Alexis, like you matter to me. I'm really excited that I get to work with you on this project, or thank you for, you know, going out of your way to, you know, bring cupcakes last week or whatever.
I really appreciate that, Claude, because everything you've mentioned isn't a complex or convoluted process. They're very simple, straightforward identifications of, hey, what do human beings need? And how can we check in and make sure they're getting what they need on that level in the organization, first and foremost? And having those questions, listening, truly listening, sets us up to say what we do next. It's not about, you know, trying to develop all these frameworks and just crazy things that we often go through to try and find solutions when we have misdiagnosed problems because we just haven't even asked the right questions first and foremost.
Right. We're not actively listening and we're listening just to interject ourselves and, you know, top-down leadership. We know what's right. Well, do you really? I mean, when was the last time you, you know, took out the trash, you know?
Agreed. Claude, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you with us on We Are Human Leaders today. Sally and I both have so much, I'm sure, to go away and think about and so ponder. Much. And I'm very confident that anyone listening to this conversation will as well. So thank you for being so gracious with your time, your energy, and your wisdom today. It's been a delight to have you here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Claude.
Thanks so much for joining us for our conversation with Claude Silver. You know, Claude's insights got me thinking, what if Chief Heart Officer was a standard C-suite role? Is there space in your company for a Chief Heart Officer and what might their impact be? You can learn more about Claude and her work at www.claudesilver.com. And if you're curious about heart-centered and human-focused leadership, become a part of the Human Leaders Movement at www.wearehumanleaders.com. Thanks for being here. See you next time.